This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet. 877-217-5757 is your number. Ronald Wilson Reagan was born on this date in 1911. He was 69 years old when he was elected president, and at that time, the oldest person to ever take the oath. And now, of course, as we look to 2024, we may have 82-year-old Joe Biden against 78-year-old Donald Trump. But Reagan did not enter politics until he was 55 years old. So we look back, he took the oath of office right at his 56th birthday as governor of California, which was half a lifetime ago for the Gipper. And he served two terms, ran for president three times, lost in 1968 to Richard Nixon, lost in 1976 to Gerald Ford in the Republican primaries, but then in 1980 he got the nomination. In fact, he was the candidate Jimmy Carter wanted to run against because he was considered a cowboy, an extremist, a wild man from the West. And Ronald Reagan ended up winning 44 states against James Earl Carter, one of the worst defeats for an incumbent president ever in 1980. And then Reagan won 49 states against Walter Mondale, Carter's vice president, in 1984. So as far as the electoral count goes, he was the most successful politician in the history of this country. 44 states the first time, 49 states the second time. But he also left a legacy of huge debt. We didn't have the problems with the deficit and the debt until Reagan became president. It went up, up, and away. And the truth is, over the last several presidencies, Republicans have invariably raised the deficit from where they started. Reagan, Bush 1, Bush 2, Trump. And Democrats have reduced the deficit. Clinton, Obama, and now Biden. But Ronald Reagan is a giant in American politics and a guy who was on the ground floor when he began his ascension to power as a former movie actor to the leader of the free world is Mike Wolfe. It was in 1966 when young Mike, pride of Baton Rouge, enrolled at Stanford University and Ronald Reagan won the presidency. He won the governorship of California. He defeated Pat Brown. Remember my history professor at LSU, Mark Carleton, was at Stanford then as well, and he said of Ronald Reagan when he was running against Pat Brown that they ran one of the most ferocious, vigorous campaigns ever, and because of Watts and unrest in the streets, Reagan capitalized and he won the leadership of the Golden State. And Mike Wolfe, you had a chance to meet him at one point, didn't you?
Yes, I did. When I was out there, I was active with the Young Republicans, and at one point we had a reception on a Young Republican event in San Francisco, and I met him at that time and had a brief discussion with him about changing the drug laws, which were just becoming seriously damaging to individual liberty at that time. Of course, and he was genial about it and said we'd have to think about that. Of course, under his presidency, the war on drugs that Nixon had declared was greatly exacerbated, and the use of mandatory minimum sentencing and intensive incarceration of victimless crimes skyrocketed.
Was he a charismatic guy?
He was. He was very, very pleasant, very, very friendly personality, easy to talk to. He was a very pleasant fellow. That was one reason for his popularity.
Even though his rhetoric was strong, I don't think he came across as a hater for those who met him one-on-one. And he had been a Democrat. In 1948, when he was at the peak of his powers as an actor, he actually campaigned for Harry Truman and for Hubert Humphrey. Robin Dow has pulled up a sampling of Ronald Reagan 1948 when he was 37 years old. It's hard to believe this is the same guy who became the leader of the Republican Party, but here he is.
Ronald Reagan speaking to you from Hollywood. You know me as a motion picture actor, but tonight I'm just a citizen. Pretty concerned about the national election next month, and more than a little impatient with those promises the Republicans made before they got control of Congress a couple of years ago. I remember listening to the radio on election night in 1946. Joseph Martin, the Republican Speaker of the House, said very solemnly, and I quote, "We Republicans intend to work for a real increase in income for everybody by encouraging more production and lower prices without impairing wages or working conditions," unquote. Remember that promise, a real increase in income for everybody. But what actually happened? The profits of corporations have doubled, while workers' wages have increased by only one quarter. In other words, profits have gone up four times as much as wages. And the small increase workers did receive was more than eaten up by rising prices.
That's Ronald Reagan, 1948. He sounded much different in 1968, 1976, 1980 when he was running for president. A complete reversal. What happened, Mike Wolff?
Well, he couldn't walk the talk. Ronald Reagan was at heart a libertarian, and he often said that libertarianism was the heart and soul of conservatism. He was important mainly for his encouragement of laissez-faire economics and free market constitutionalism in government, but it was mostly a matter of rhetoric and not accomplishment. Under him, he claimed he was going to reduce the size and scope of government, but the size and scope of government increased. He said he was going to eliminate the departments of education and energy, but instead they grew under him. And as you mentioned in the intro, the national debt started going up under Reagan. The debt increased by $2 trillion over his 8 years in office.
And it was less than $1 billion when he took over. So
it was $900 billion. It was nearly a trillion. The debt, not the deficit. You emphasized
okay,
the deficit.
Okay, I got you. It went from like $900 billion to $4 trillion,
nearly $3 trillion
okay.
in 89. And by the way, when you talk about Clinton and Obama, it went up $1.7 trillion under.
That's true. Not under Clinton.
Under 8 years of Clinton, it went up $1.7 trillion, the debt.
I'll give you that. But the deficit, of course, was erased altogether, and he left with a surplus. But when you start—
In one year, the deficit's an annual thing.
The first year of Bush, too, which I think he gets credit for. But if you start at a certain level, Mike, like Obama did, historic deficit spending, and you bring it gradually down, which he did, you're still going to leave with a huge increase in the debt, but he also, Clinton and Obama, had huge decreases in the overall deficit. And I remember Rush Limbaugh used to conflate those two, intentionally, I might add, to make people think that Democrats were just red ink people, and Republicans, of course, were stewards of the economy and balancing the budget. And the truth is, it's just the opposite when you look at the raw numbers.
No, sir. The truth is that they both have done it continually. Under Obama, the debt went up $8 trillion in 8 years.
I agree. It went from 12 to 20, but the deficit came down during his tenure.
The deficit is an annual figure.
That is correct, Mike.
But
if he had not reduced the deficit, the debt would have been more. And the debt went from what, 20 to 30 some trillion when Trump was in office for just 4 years? For just 4 years?
In Trump, it went up $9 trillion, the debt.
In 4 years. Obama went up $8 trillion in 8 years. David in Atlanta. David, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana. Hi, David.
Good morning, gentlemen. There was a time when low-income people, Social Security withholding wasn't withheld, and then they retired, they had no Social Security. So there was a special 122 minimum Social Security monthly payment. Ronald Reagan proposed to take that away, and it was put in his tax cut bill, and there was such a public backlash. Reagan didn't sign the bill, although he fully intended to, had it not been for the backlash. He was cutting a 25% tax cuts for billionaires while he was taking a measly $122 a month away from dirt poor people.
All right. David's saying that Reagan was a rich guy's president. I don't think that's breaking news, but the information he provided is, of course, I'm sure, sourced, because everything David says is sourced. Your thoughts about whether he was better for the rich guys than for the poor guys?
Well, he lowered taxes, and he was sold by Laffer and others on the supply-side economics, in which they basically said they thought lowering taxes would stimulate government revenues and stimulate the economy. And by the way, it's wrong for anybody to attribute everything that happens in a presidential administration to the president. You've got a Congress enacting the laws there, including the taxes and the spending plans, the budget plans. But under Reagan, there was in 1983 a plan. They appointed a commission to study Social Security to keep it solvent for the future, and the outcome of that was an adjustment of the FICA taxes, and they raised the limit of income that they would be paid on. And the outcome of that is still going on. Basically, the retirement age was raised from 65 to 67, and depending on the age of the retiree. And so he did help put Social Security on a sound basis, but it did result in raising taxes and in some cases reducing benefits.
Rebel in Sherwood. Rebel, you're on with Mike.
Thank you so much, Jim, and thank you, Mr. Mike, Mr. Wolf. Since we're remembering Ronald Reagan today, I'd also like to bring up not just the tripling of the deficit, the Iran-Contra affair, which he should have been impeached and imprisoned for, but they covered that up as well. And, of course, I remember most for voodoo economics and the destruction of the middle class. I'd like to get your points on that.
All right. Well, we have reflected on those to some degree, and we'll get a wrap-up from Mike. And, of course, Reagan, he was, according to many, responsible for the downfall of the Soviet Union. We'll talk about that as well when we return. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We're discussing the complex legacy of the 40th American president, one of the most popular ever, and certainly the electoral results speak of that. 44 states, first time Reagan won in 1980, defeating an incumbent president, and 49 states the second time. So he was a popular president. He left office. He was shot in office shortly after he took the oath, March 30th, 1981, almost killed by John Hinckley, who's now out of jail and singing on YouTube. The world's a strange place, but Ronald Reagan died in 2004. He was 93 years old, and he fought Alzheimer's the last decade of his life. And I think he, in many ways, he was a true American. He was not a silver spoon guy. He started in radio, and he became one of the most influential people of the last half of the 20th century. But Mike Wolf, we were commenting about his complex legacy, and I want to kind of get a wrap-up from you about whether you think he was good or bad on the whole.
Well, intermediate, basically. He was good in some respects, bad in others. In hindsight, Reagan looks better. He looks better by comparison to the Bushes and Trump and the people that came after him. But at the time, he appeared to be an arch-conservative. He gave encouragement to the religious right, but he personally favored tolerance and claimed that people shouldn't be protected from themselves, from their own vices. But later on, this got away from him, and he moved toward ultra-conservative social positions, or he allowed them to take place despite his administration. So he went against his principles. But he's important mainly for his celebration and promotion of liberal, that means libertarian, economic principles, conservative economics.
877-217-5757. On deck is Mariana Alfaro from the Washington Post to comment about tomorrow night's State of the Union address from the current president, Joseph Robinette Biden Jr., who was born in the year of 1942. He's an old man, but to put it in perspective, he's 31 years younger than Ronald Reagan was. And Biden was in the U.S. Senate for all 8 of the years that Reagan was president of the United States. Jeff in Spanish Town, you're our final caller for Mike. Please be concise. You're on, Jeff.
Good morning. Great topic. So I'm 61 years old. When I turned 18 and I was able to vote for the first time, I could not wait to vote for Ronald Reagan. I voted for him twice. Today, and I have been for the last probably 10, 50 years, I'm a very proud Democrat. Reagan was what we needed at the time. History has proven his economics and a lot of the, you know, the controversy stuff will prove, you know, it didn't work. But I do believe, as an American first, at the time, we needed Ronald Reagan. You know, we just got out of Vietnam in 75 and everything else. He did a lot of bad things. Economic stuff did not work, but he was one hell of an American.
Yeah, he made America feel good about itself, and I don't think that can be discounted, Mike, is that he was a person who made the country unite in a way. They certainly united in voting for him, and we didn't have the same kind of BS we had during the last administration. I think Donald Trump was a divider, and Ronald Reagan, in his own way, was a uniter. And the thing that I admire most about him is something I've commented, is that his two children with Nancy turned out to have minds of their own, and their politics are much different. Ron Reagan's an atheist, and I like the fact that a person like Reagan allowed his kids to be individuals. I hate it when husbands and wives say, we voted for so-and-so. Well, people are individuals. They're not appendages, Mike Wolf.
Sure, and Ron Reagan's not afraid of burning in hell, as we all know.
That's what he says.
The caller was correct, though, in many ways. And one of the things to add about Reagan is that he kept Paul Volcker, who was appointed by Jimmy Carter, and reappointed him chairman of the Federal Reserve. And because of that, they got rid of the stagflation of the 70s. So that was a big part of his legacy.
Well, Ronald Reagan, born in Tampico, Illinois, on this date in 1911, 112 short years ago. Mariana Alfaro is with us. She is a reporter of note with one of the great entities in American journalism, the Washington Post, and she is following the current president with earnest. Joseph Biden goes before the masses tomorrow night. And Mariana, let's start with perception. The perception with Reagan was that he was a vigorous man. Of course, he had been an actor, and he played the part well as president, seemed to be enjoying what he's doing. Biden, according to his critics, is not all there, that he's practically on life support. Now, those of us who follow him know that's not the case, but he is an older man, and at times he looks every bit of his 80 years. Your thoughts about what he needs to do as far as appeasing the American people as he approaches what is apparent an election campaign, re-election, that he is fit for the job?
Yeah, so what you can expect to see tomorrow is exactly that, just like a warm-up run of the pitch that he's going to give us for 2024. And as you mentioned, yes, you know, we know Biden is the oldest president. We know also that, you know, sometimes his speeches can be a little rambling. Again, we've had a president who really went on long rants. So at this point, you know, as long as they don't fully deviate from what's on the teleprompter, I think it's a win. But, you know, we are having the State of the Union come a day after, you know, we have a new poll with the Washington Post and ABC that says that a majority of Americans don't believe that Biden has achieved much since taking office, which, again, if you follow the president, if you follow Congress, as we do on a daily basis, you know that that is actually not true. There's a lot of, you know, a string of legislative successes, you know, just naming off some gun control last year, a lot of, you know, the gay marriage bill. There was a lot of, like, the Infrastructure Act, like the measure that passed immediately when he took office that helped, you know, rebuild the economy after the pandemic. A lot of these things, I think that the administration has tried to sell to the public, but they haven't been successful at it. So I think that tomorrow Biden has a really good chance to really sell those things to the public, to remind them that they have happened already.
Well, Joe Biden may be blessed by the fact that Donald Trump is his foil. Mm-hmm. Biden, his poll numbers are not good, but Trump's are even lower. Is it inevitable, or can something be stopped? Perhaps, you know, tomorrow night a gaffe might be made, or something really inspiring might help Biden. What would stop the inertia of a Trump-Biden rematch?
Definitely, I want to call it like a miracle, but definitely just like a better showing, a better solid, to-the-point speech, like not a lot of like rambling or deviating. It's definitely something that can remind the public in a very straightforward point-by-point fashion of this is what we've done with this administration, this is what's going to happen next, and also maybe not laying it off so heavy on the Republicans. I think that that is the thing. If the Democrats continue, you know, I know that they are having a difficult time negotiating with Republicans right now, especially on the debt ceiling, but I think that the idea of continue making the other party the enemy is just going to make it more likely that we'll end up with a Trump-Biden rematch in 2024. And so I think that that is something the president, I think, is looking forward to not doing. You know, he's kind of appeared on stage with Mitch McConnell already. He met with McCarthy last week. I think he's trying to make those inroads to be like, I'm still a bipartisan. I'm still hoping to work with both sides of the aisle. And I think we're going to see a little bit of that tomorrow.
Mariana Alfaro is with us. She covers the presidency for the Washington Post. And as Biden looks ahead to a U.S. House that is now dominated, and when I say dominated, when you have the majority, it is total domination unless something changes. And right now, Kevin McCarthy has the ability to block anything Biden wants. He had a meeting with McCarthy. Do you think anything happened to perhaps make McCarthy do deals with Biden, or is that off the table?
Yeah, so they met. They were going to discuss a lot of things, but at the end of the day, the main thing right now is the debt ceiling. And we've heard Republicans led by McCarthy say that they're not willing to, you know, lift the ceiling without negotiation. They want to make a deal on it, and Democrats don't. And Biden has doubled down that he won't. And we haven't really heard Biden's side of that conversation yet, but when McCarthy came out of that meeting at the White House, he was all smiles. He was very optimistic. He said, he didn't say deal. He said, we can reach an agreement. And so I think that, and the White House didn't they didn't refute that. So I think that there is some agreement or there's some kind of discussions going there that might actually be friendlier. Again, this is extremely optimistic take. I think that everyone's trying to like lower the temperatures right now. But I do think that, you know, the fact that they met, even though they had spent, you know, weeks jabbing at each other, I think that was a positive step forward.
We're hearing the voice of Mariana Alfaro, who covers the White House for The Washington Post. We'll spend a few more minutes with her, and then we'll hear from LSU economist Jim Richardson, one of the best in the business, with what happens if the debt ceiling is not lifted. We're back with more Talk Louisiana after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is producing, and we turn the page. Robin says we're switching to Jim Richardson, and we're always pleased to catch up with him. It's been too long. The veteran economist, who was a person who was put in charge of the Revenue Estimating Conference back in 1987, and when he announced his retirement from that post, a story that appeared starts like this. It was in The Advocate. The governors have come and gone over the years. The legislative leaders have come and gone. The budget crises have come and gone. But in the Louisiana State Capitol, economist Jim Richardson has been the one constant on state budget and tax issues over the past 32 years. The LSU economics professor has served as an independent, professionally unimpeachable authority on one of the most powerful government panels in the state. But the self-effacing Richardson, not one to draw attention to himself, will step down during the next 2 months from his appointed position on the Revenue Estimating Conference that determines how much money is available for lawmakers to spend each year. And in Louisiana, as in most other states, we are constitutionally not allowed to run deficits. And the Republican Congress, perhaps to its credit, would like to see something like that in Washington. But obviously, if you've got a huge deficit, you cannot just erase it overnight without killing the economy. And when the deficit, no matter how small it is, grows or it continues, then the debt grows. And when the debt grows, the debt ceiling has to be raised or the U.S. defaults on all kinds of obligations. And we're hearing that the economy would just crater. Jim Richardson, is that an exaggeration or is that the truth? What's your take on what would happen if McCarthy and the Republicans do not agree to raise the debt ceiling that Joe Biden and Donald Trump and all the other presidents who've had to deal with this have done so many times? Your thoughts?
Well, I would think, Jim, first, it depends on how long you're talking about. If it's a day and then they come to an agreement, it's not going to be a big deal. But if it's a week, a month, that becomes then a major issue, because what's going on at that time is the government's still getting money in, taxes they collect, excise fees, different types of fees they collect, they're getting money in. But the fact is they're also having to pay money out. And now they will not have enough money to pay people, all the people that they really owe. And that could be paychecks for federal employees, for the military. It could be payments for transfer payments for Social Security, Medicare payments to healthcare facilities, and so on. So there's a whole list of things that would happen, and the Treasury would have to somehow deal with that. At that point, I think there'd be some major problems. But I would think that the question is that we the debt ceiling itself is kind of a silly thing we've had on the books since 1939. But we can't get rid of it, apparently. And what really the fact is, the financial markets are not saying they will not take our debt. But we have a political system which says we have a debt ceiling. And it's been there. It's been raised every time we need to raise it. It is not limited to anything at all. Now, it is a negotiating tool, though. And right now, that's what the people, the Republicans, want to cut spending some, want to use it as a negotiating tool. And at some point, they will come to an agreement. But the question is how much pressure that puts on financial markets. And if indeed they don't come to an agreement, there is a major problem. And like I said, it depends on if it's a week, a day, a week, a month.
Well, it appears both sides are playing politics, and the Democrats have a playbook that the last time Newt Gingrich tried something similar to this, it backfired. Public opinion went way against him and went for President Clinton. And, of course, as we've stated in our previous discussion with Mike Wolf, the deficit was actually heading in the right direction under Clinton to the point where he left with a yearly surplus. The deficit is heading in the right direction under Joe Biden. It dropped $1.4 trillion in 1 year last year. So with it moving in the right direction, why is there this immediacy about we've suddenly got to balance the budget overnight or we're going to kill the economy? Your thoughts?
Well, I don't know. Some of it's political, how they see the political landscape possibly. But the fact is that the federal government's budget is not like any state budget because there's no capital outlay. So we spend money on roads for the last 50 years. We count that as a current expenditure. So the federal budget is very different from any budget a state has or a major company has in terms of how we line things up. I think in this situation, it is going, if you get the economy recovering, which it is, and hopefully maintains that, then the deficit will naturally fall. Now, if indeed we fall into a recession, which some people are forecasting, the deficit will rise, which is what it's supposed to do, because that's how you kind of automatic stabilizer in the economy. But I think if we can maintain the growth and that we now have and not fall into a recession, the deficit will get lower. It does not mean it will go away entirely, though.
Got a long way to go.
No, and the other element is there's always going to be disagreements about spending programs. That's going to be natural between different. It could be Republican versus Democrat, could be conservative versus liberal, could be the states in the East against states in the South. Who knows? But I mean, there are always going to be differences in terms of spending programs, just like there are going to be differences in terms of tax programs.
Jim Richardson. Man who was chair of the Department of Economics at LSU, was also dean of the College of Business Administration, associate vice chancellor for academic affairs. He came here from the University of Michigan a couple of generations ago. He was a legendary presence in the classroom. People often don't know how good these people are in the classroom, and another Jim was pretty good at that too, and he was known as the chancellor, but people who learned chemistry from Jim Wharton said he was the best. Well, Jim, I've heard the same thing about you in economics, putting in layman's terms, and it's something that many journalists, for example, really don't appreciate and often mistake the two entities, the deficit and the debt, are two different things. But in order to reduce the deficit, and by the way, if the deficit's to reduce, the debt still goes up unless we have a balanced budget, but in order to do that, you generally also have to raise taxes, and Republicans don't want to do that, and it would seem it's almost impossible to accomplish a balanced budget without an increase in taxes, isn't it?
Well, it depends on your time horizon. If you're looking over the next 20 years, no. If you maintain spending, you could do it over a long period of time. If you're talking about a very short period of time, say 3 years, probably not. So it depends on your time horizon there. And even there, if you raise taxes, that has its positive effects in terms of positive balancing, helping balance a budget. But it also can create some slowdowns in the economy, which then works against balancing the budget because people don't buy as much. Their people get laid off possibly and things like that. So it's a very complicated process. And I think in this situation, we can talk about tax rate increases in taxes. I don't think that's going to happen. I think the one thing that may happen, they may, and this depends on the 2024 election probably, they may raise the top marginal tax rate from 37% to 39.6%. I doubt if they'll increase any other personal taxes at that point. But that's a political issue. that will be decided in at the polls, really.
All right. Tracy at the Capitol asked me to ask you about this story that is everywhere. A group of House Republicans close to Kevin McCarthy is pushing to eliminate most federal taxes and replace them with a federal sales tax in a plan that would abolish the IRS. Some tax experts warn the so-called Fair Tax Act is not so fair to working families, which would, of course, mean that sales taxes go up. That's considered a regressive tax, and it would give wealthy Americans a tax break. Is this going anywhere, Jim Richardson?
Again, my political instinct is no. It's not going any place at all, because what you're looking at is right now, the major tax at the federal level is the personal income tax. And then the next major tax is the, essentially the Social Security tax. Well, if you try to make all the money you get from the personal income tax up by putting a sales tax, you're going to have a very large rate, which is going to be very scary. It's also going to have a major impact on almost every state, because almost every state in the country, maybe six or seven, have a sales tax. And like Louisiana has a sales tax. We also do local governments have a sales tax. It would mean that sales tax rate in total, federal plus the state and local, could well be 40% or so. And think about that when you buy a car, buy a new washing machine, buy a new refrigerator, or buy something, a big ticket item, maybe an engagement ring or something like that. You're talking about big money. And I would think politically, you know, that's not going to go any place. Now, remember, though, the value-added tax, the tax that you have in Europe a great deal, raises a lot of money. And it would be an alternative. But, again, that's a new tax in this country. Nobody's used to it. If you talk about it, I think you'll see a lot of, wait, we aren't going to do that.
All right, Kevin in North Baton Rouge. Kevin, we want to get you in before the break. You're on with Jim Richardson. Hi, Kevin.
How you doing? The way Trump taxes showed up is the way a lot of these rich people's taxes show up. We just need a whole different group of people running this country, because you don't want to raise taxes on the rich.
All right. Ronald Reagan was one of those who believed that raising taxes on the rich would actually cripple the economy. But you got to find the money somewhere, and sometimes you got to fish where the fish are. Rich people generally have more to pay in taxes than do poor people. Jim Richardson, if you'll stay with us, we will take a short break, and we will return. 877-217-5757 is your number. We'll also hear from Goldie Taylor, if things go according to form, one of the fine writers in American life. We're back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana in our final quarter hour. We'll finish up with Jim Richardson, and on deck is one of the exceptional writers of her generation, Goldie Taylor, with a huge new book that is out and about. I do want to wrap it up with Patricia in Magnolia Woods, has been waiting for a little while to talk with Jim. Patricia, you're on. Please be concise. What is your question for Dr. Richardson?
Good morning. My question is, so in Louisiana, we have a lot of working poor, working full-time, but still requiring government benefits. What do you think would be a good minimum wage for Louisiana in order to allow people to support their families? Thanks.
All right. We haven't had an increase in the minimum wage in well over a decade. Your thoughts, Jim?
Yeah. The minimum wage is one of those elements that has some good sides and some bad sides. I would say right now in Louisiana, the fact of the matter is the minimum wage is probably irrelevant, because the state does not have one. The federal minimum wage is $7.25. It's not changed since George W. Bush's 2007, I believe it was.
We did have one little increase under Obama early on, but that was, you know, that's 2009, I think, so...
Yeah. Oh, yeah, but that 14 years. That was the last stage of a three-year of a process that changed over 3 years, I think, starting with Bush in 2005 or 6, something like that. But it was a process, and it did change just up 725. But since that time, I mean, if you're going to, the average wage in Louisiana is going to be higher than that. Now, the minimum wage also has negative effects. If you put it too high, you can deter companies from hiring people. So I think it's a matter of the market solves that problem for the most part. But then you see, like Seattle went to $15, certain areas in New York, but those are very different different states than what we are in terms of the cost of living and things like that. I would think here, if anything above $10 may be anti, could be hurt people from getting jobs. But again, that the market takes care of that pretty well without any type of government interference.
And I believe it's $11 going up to $12 in Arkansas, which is not a rich state either. But Jim, always a pleasure, and it's been too long. Let's get you back very soon. It's an honor to speak with Dr. Jim Richardson. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Jim. Take care now. Bye.
And joining us now is Goldie Taylor, an exceptional writer who writes about American life, and she is back with a huge book, The Love You Save. She describes herself as a writer, a food enthusiast, and an uncommitted runner. And Goldie, you have written about many things independent of the books, but your thoughts about the process of writing and your latest work.
You know, thanks, Jim, for having me this morning. I am so appreciative of this time and space. And, you know, when I wrote The Love You Save, I just spent a lot of time peeling back the years, not just for me, but for our family and for the broader community in which we came to grow. I really wanted to talk about some of the issues I think are most unsettling to me in America, the scourge of poverty and gun violence, you know, the notion of a broken public education system and how children come to growth in this country. And so I wanted to do that through my own lens, but through the lens of our family as well. It was a tough thing to write, but I think that for me, it was a bit of a salve for a wound that was still well opened.
Well, Goldie is a journalist, political analyst, human rights activist. She's been featured on NBC, MSNBC, ABC, CNN, and many other journalistic entities, including All Things Considered. She's written for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and we could go on from there. But The Love You Save is a revealing memoir. And I would imagine that some of these pages you had to really think about before you let the whole world see what you were about to put on paper.
Oh, most certainly. You know, I have never been fearful truly about telling my own story, the things that I experience on this world of ours. But what was the hesitance for me was giving a snapshot in time of the people who populated my life then and who they've become today. I don't think any of us operates at standstill, that we all grow and evolve over time, as did, you know, many of the people who inhabited my life. And so my hesitance was talking about them in their worst moments and not being able to see present day where they're in some of their best moments. That was the real hesitancy, truly, for me. I'll tell you what else happened. You know, I revealed quite a bit about my childhood and living through what I called casual violence, casual cruelty, sexual violence, and what happened to me. An older cousin, just days after publication, came forward to talk about what happened to her. She'd held that for over 50 years. And so, in so many ways, it was freeing for me, but it's been freeing for many of the readers. And for that, I'm grateful.
The Love You Save. Remember the Jackson 5 song? It was a good one, but this is an exceptional book, a Zibby's most anticipated book of 2023. What was the most difficult aspect of your life to write about?
I think the most difficult aspect really was a theme running through the book, which was how little of my mother I had as a young girl. My father was murdered when I was 5, and I don't think she ever got over losing him. She's 80 years old today, and I don't think a day has gone by without her grieving over his loss. But I lost something in that, too, because my mother had, she was already at work, but she had to take a second and third job. She worked night shifts at a Marriott hotel and overnights at a nearby bar, just trying to put enough ends together to make certain that her children were fed and were clothed. And when she couldn't do it on her own, she had me go live with my Aunt Gerald and Uncle Ross. And while their household was tumultuous in a whole lot of ways and dysfunctional in a lot of ways, It was also a safe place for me to sleep at night for the most part, where my mother didn't have to worry about, where I was, that I would be underfoot. Someone was taking care of me. The most difficult part was to write about my separation from her. It continues to be the most difficult part of my life today, even though today we have such a wonderful and glorious relationship, that I was a little girl who didn't have her mama. That was the most difficult part.
And this was in East St. Louis. Now, we in the South often don't consider Missouri a southern state, and of course, East St. Louis is an urban setting, but it has many of the same aspects, let's say, of Atlanta or New Orleans. There are a lot of black people who I'm sure were held down by the laws of the land, and there are vestiges of the Jim Crow South. How much of a factor was that in your youth?
You know, when we came to grow up in East St. Louis, which sits really just across the road from St. Louis, Missouri, on the Illinois side, it had a population of around 50,000 people. Today, that number is under 20,000. When we were coming to growth in the early 80s, crack cocaine was beginning to make its way across the country. With that came guns and violence. That really tore the city down, tore away its tax base, made it so that affordable housing, wasn't available. The housing stock was really tough. Nearly the house we lived in should have been condemned long before we moved out of it. Food instability, welfare dependency was a huge thing in East St. Louis back then. But before we were in East St. Louis, before the city was predominantly black, it was predominantly white. And Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois would tell you that if you couldn't find a job in East St. Louis, you couldn't find a job anywhere. But by the time I came along, less than 1% of the city's working class worked a full-time job year-round. And so debilitating poverty. But I think what I look back and see in all of that and the people I came to growth with, that poverty wasn't a moral question. It's a question of access to opportunity. It was a question of having a quality basic education that would give you a formidable chance of having a great future for yourself. And mm-hmm. So I looked at, what was really happening to us and then, what we were doing as a people. And our family survived, quite frankly, because of faith, because we were raised by country folk who understood the value of a book. And so it was really it's a tough thing to write about, but I really wanted to write about it from both sides. What do individuals have as personal responsibility? And then what do we have as a society in terms of our responsibilities to make sure that avenues are available, that this American dream is available to anyone who seeks it?
The Love You Save, a memoir about her youth in East St. Louis, and as mentioned, her father was murdered. How did that affect you?
That was devastating for me. Even at 5 years old, I knew what death was. I knew what it meant to be murdered. Unfortunately, living the lives that we were, that it wasn't uncommon. But to have it hit our house in just such that way has lived with me my entire life long. And so not only has other grieved him every day, but I think I have as well. There is something missing when a little girl doesn't have her daddy. There's an air of protection. There is, the first love that you know of a man. All of those things are important. And so when I look back on his leaving, on his murder, I look at how it broke our family down in a way that I'm not sure it has been repaired today.
Well, her book is getting exceptional plaudits, and for good reason. Gabrielle Union says, a deeply inspiring must-read memoir about the transformative power of books to heal and unite us, from Goldie Taylor, a journalist of note who has told her story in all its graphic detail, a brave story, The Love You Save. And thanks for spending time with us this morning, Goldie.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Jim.
And congratulations on your important work. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support for Talk Louisiana. We're back tomorrow, same time, same place. Until then, stay safe and stay tuned.